Today, I want to talk about how to see the invisible hand of God at work in our lives. You know, when I was a young person, I was a magician, and I once designed an illusion whereby I make my assistant disappear from the stage. Now, the truth of the matter is, she never actually left the stage. She was there the entire time. But the audience assumes that at some point, we must have whisked her off the stage because, after all, they couldn't see her. Now, the way a magician pulls off something like that is, of course, he has to misdirect the audience's attention and what they're focusing upon. And so it is in the spiritual realm. You know, God never leaves. He never abandons us. He's always here. But because we sometimes have the wrong focus, we feel as if he has left us and abandoned us. We find ourselves saying things like, "Where is God in all of this? Where was God when such and such happened in my life?" And this principle is wonderfully illustrated for us in the book of Esther. So today I'm going to talk about the overall message and the theme of the book of Esther and the lessons that we learn from it. And Esther is a very interesting and unique book in the Bible in a number of ways. But one of the things that makes Esther unique is the fact that God is never once mentioned in the entire book of Esther. Not once. God's just never mentioned there. Now, this is such a contrast to the other books of the Bible where God is repeatedly referenced and he intervenes in the affairs of mankind. He does miracles and he reveals himself through dreams and visions, or perhaps he sends an angel to grant a message. Sometimes even Jesus himself makes a pre-incarnate appearance. Jesus himself appearing to people such as Abraham and Moses and Joshua and so forth. God sometimes will even draw back the curtain of the unseen realm and gives us a glimpse into that unseen world in the pages of the Bible. But we find none of this in the book of Esther. And that is all the more surprising when you recall that the whole point of the Bible is it is supposed to be to us a revelation of God. The Bible is God's vehicle for revealing himself and making himself known to us. Because Christianity, of course, is all about having a personal relationship with God, getting to know him and his heart, and the Bible is how this happens. So sitting down and reading the Bible is like sitting down and having a conversation with God. And you read the Bible and say, "God, tell me about yourself. What are the things you like? What are the things you don't like? What are the things that are most important to you?" And so it's a revelation of God himself to us. And again, this is one of the things that sets apart the Bible from all the other religions of the world. Most religions have some kind of a holy book, but the holy book usually just contains a bunch of do's and don'ts. That's really all it is. It's a manual with the do's and don'ts, or the tips and the techniques that you have to do if you're going to achieve such and such with your life. If you're going to do get here, then you've got to walk through all these hoops and do these things. So it's all the list of the things that you do or don't do. An example of this would be in the religion of Islam. Any Muslim will tell you that to them their holy book, the Quran, is not a revelation of Allah to you. For Allah is not interested in having a personal relationship with you or you getting to know him. Instead, he is the sovereign of the universe and you are nothing more than his slave. And so the Quran is nothing more than a list of his expectations. Here's what I want you to know. Here's what I want you to believe. Here's what I want you to do. Just do it. Don't get to know me. You don't need to know me. Just do what I told you to do. That's the Quran from the Muslim perspective. And so you see, the Bible is unique in this regard, that it's not about a bunch of do's and don'ts. It's about getting to know God. It's supposed to be a revelation of God. And yet here in the Bible, this revelation of God, we have an entire book that never once even references God. So then, how do we encounter God in the book of Esther? Well, the key is that we see God through the vehicle of providence. God is here, but he's here implicitly rather than explicitly. And thus it is in the book of Esther, we see all of life from our perspective, the way that most of us actually experience life. Because although, yeah, there are a lot of miracles in the Bible and so forth, you know, we today in the 21st century, you know, we're not exactly seeing miracles every day. You know, God has never appeared to me in a dream or a vision. God has never sent an angel to me with a message. I've never walked on water or seen anybody walk on water. That stuff doesn't happen in my life day to day. And so the book of Esther is very relevant to us today in the 21st century. It really resonates with us because it shows us real events that transpired in history just from the perspective that you and I have of our everyday lives. It's how we approach life. And thus it is, the book of Esther teaches us how to see the invisible hand of God at work in our lives. And so today, I want us to review the basic story of Esther, and along the way, then, we'll examine how we find and encounter God in this story, even though he's never once mentioned, and never once visibly or obviously manifest himself. Let me begin by giving you a basic overview of the book and how it is structured. And as is typical with so much Hebrew literature in the Old Testament, the book is structured using the device of repetition, a parallelism of ideas or a pairing of ideas that are complementary. We saw this last week with the way that the book of Daniel structures chapters 2 through 7 as a unit in that book. And in a similar fashion, the entire book of Esther is structured like that. And so, for example, we could visualize it as a series of concentric circles. Now, the first two chapters, represented by the left side of the outermost ring, the red circle, well, that's really just the prologue of the book. It is here in the prologue that we're kind of introduced to some of the key characters and so forth, and sets the scene. This would be complemented by the final chapter, represented by the right side of the circle, chapter 10, where we just have an epilogue. As we work our way in, we get to the blue circle. The left side of the blue circle, chapters 3 through 4, we find the king issuing a royal decree. And this is complemented later by the right side of the blue circle in chapters 8 and 9, where once again the king issues yet another decree. So we have the two royal decrees. As we progress inward in the circle, we get to the green circle, and the left side of the circle, chapter 5, we get to this conflict that arises between Haman and Mordecai, and then again, chapter 6 and 7, we've got the whole story of Haman and Mordecai and their interactions. And then finally, smack dab in the middle, the bullseye of the target, so to speak, there is one final aspect of the story, but I don't want to talk about that yet, so we're going to leave that as a question, as a mystery, and later we'll come back to that. But in general, that's basically how the book of Esther is structured. Now, having seen that then, let's basically walk through the story of Esther. Of course, we'll learn some lessons along the way. Again, we start with chapters 1 through 2, which is the prologue of the book. Here again is where he sets the scene of the story and introduces us to the key characters. Among these are King Ahasuerus, also known to us in history as King Xerxes, who reigned over the Persian Empire from 486 to 465 BC. Here also, we're introduced to his queen, Esther, who certainly is a hero in the story. Here also, we're introduced to her uncle, Mordecai, who reared her like his own daughter and has a job working there in the palace and the royal administration. So that's the prologue. As we progress then into chapters 3 through 5, this is where the plot thickens. Here now is where conflict and adversity is introduced into the story. And after all good drama has to have a conflict that's got to be resolved. And so we get conflict, all right, in chapters 3 through 5. And the source of the conflict derives from the chief antagonist in the story, who would be this fellow named Haman. Haman is a proud and arrogant, glory-seeking individual who's trying ever to increase his fortunes and rise in power. He's a close associate of the king. He enjoys the access to the king, and he wants to continue, growing in power and influence throughout the Persian Empire. Now, we said he's the antagonist, and that is because he's not just a proud and arrogant fella; he's an evil fella. And there are two ways in which he manifests his wickedness. First of all, in chapters 3 through 4, we find out that he wants to wipe out the Jewish people. He wants literally to commit genocide against the entire Jewish people. Just like the Nazis in World War II, he wants to wipe them out. And so he cons the king into writing a royal decree that accomplish just that. He convinces the king, you know, they're not large in numbers, not a lot of Jews in the empire, and they're a lot of troublemakers. You'd be best served if we just kind of did away with them. And so this is recorded for us in chapter 3, verses 8 through 11. Notice, for example, what we're told in chapter 3, verses 8 through 11. Now Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. And so the king says, yeah, I issued a decree. Here's my royal signet ring. Decree goes forth. Now, the way he sets this up is that we learn from some of the other details of the story that Haman, of course, he's a superstitious fella, as all the ancient pagans were. They believed in the gods and so forth, and in astrology and divining and so forth. And so using his belief in magic and divining, he divines the perfect date to establish this. And so he puts the date on the calendar, and on this day, then the decree goes forth that certain people among the Persian Empire to go forth armed to just wipe and kill out the Jews. And the Jews, of course, they're not allowed to arm themselves and protect themselves, so they're going to be wiped out. So the date is put on the calendar for their destruction. Now, it's not the Jews in general that he hates. There is one Jew in particular that he absolutely cannot stand. And so not as he's going to wipe out all the Jews, he wants to kill this one guy. And the one guy is Esther's uncle Mordecai, who, as we have observed, serves in the administration of the king. And so notice how this comes about in chapter 5, in verse 9. We're told in chapter 5, verse 9, then went Haman forth that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation against Mordecai. You see, Haman was, as we said, a glory seeker, and he loved all the attention and the deference that people gave to him because he was such a powerful man and you know, good with the king. But Mordecai wasn't impressed with his power. Mordecai wasn't impressed with him in the least. And so Mordecai wouldn't show him the deference that he wanted. And he couldn't stand it. Everybody else literally trembled, moved, as the King James says, before him. But he didn't move. That is, he didn't shake, he didn't quiver, nothing. He wasn't the least bit intimidated by Haman. And that really got to him. So, what does he do? Well, he decides he's going to have to put an end to Mordecai, and he's not waiting until the date on the calendar. He wants this done right away. So notice how the story continues, verses 10 through 14 here in chapter 5, verses 10 through 14. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself, and when he came home, he sent and called for his friends and Zeresh, his wife. And Haman told them of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him and how he had advanced him above all the princes and servants of the king. Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared, but myself. And tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. And yet, all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then said Zeresh his wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king, that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. So his wife and his friends say, well, if you don't like the guy, yeah, why wait till the day of the genocide? Let's just go ahead and ask if the king's permission to put him to death tomorrow. Go ahead and let's give the order, let's go and start building the gallows. So here we have great adversity introduced into the story. Is first of all, he wants to kill all the Jews in general and kill Mordecai in particular. That's what I call a time of trial and adversity for sure. Excuse me. Now, in such times of adversity, we're certainly tempted to ask, where is God? Where is God at a time like this? But you know, such adversity such adversity best allows God to manifest himself in our lives. Without this kind of adversity, think of it, we would have never heard of Esther and Mordecai and the great working of God in this story. Never heard of them had it not been for that adversity. And so it is in our lives. Adversity often is a wonderful tool that gets us asking, where is God? It gets us wondering about God. And if we allow it, it will send us in a true and honest and sincere search for God. And that's exactly what God wants. You know, in Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 13 through 14, we have a promise from God. God says, "And ye shall seek me and find me." When? When you search for me with all your heart. And I will be found of you, says the Lord. And so God says, listen, if you go searching for me, I mean sincerely, I mean with all your heart, you will find me. I'm not going to veil myself from anybody who truly wants to know me. And so such times of adversity become a wonderful vehicle for getting us to go on a search for God. Now, in the case of this particular adversity, where the Jews are about to be wiped out and Mordecai is about to be put to death tomorrow, well, it allows God to manifest his providence, his providential working in two key ways. First of all, as the story progresses in chapters 6 through 9, we find God's providence manifested through his protection and deliverance of the Jewish people. Or, turns out, no genocide takes place. They manage to survive, just as God brought them through the Holocaust. God will bring him through this as well, and he does. Now, how does this unfold? Well, first of all, in chapters 6 through 7, we deal with the issue of Mordecai. And here is where we find God working providentially to do a total reversal. I mean, a total turnabout. Because it was Haman who wanted to see the total ruination and destruction of Mordecai. But it doesn't turn out that way at all. Instead, it's Mordecai who sees the total destruction and ruination of Haman. And there are two parts of this. First of all, remember that Haman was a real glory hog. He wanted all this great glory, but all the glory he sought and hungered for, instead of going to him, ends up going to Mordecai, and Mordecai's not even seeking for any glory. He doesn't want it, but it comes his way anyway. And this is one of the aspects of the story that reveals the humor of God. It's often been said that God works in mysterious ways, and that's true. But it's also true that God has a sense of humor, and he sometimes works in funny ways. And so we see this illustrated in this part of the story, in the way in which God totally turns issues about. So look, for example, at chapter 6 and verse 4. Chapter 6 and verse 4. We're told that the king said unto, the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman was coming to the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said unto him, "Behold, Haman standeth in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in. And the king said unto him, "What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighted to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than to myself?" So Haman answered the king, "Oh, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought which the king uses to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of the one whom the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with all whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighted to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Well, then make haste, and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken." Then took Haman the apparel and the horse, and arrayed Mordecai, and brought him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighted to honor." And then Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his house, mourning and having his head covered. And so here you have Haman coming to the king. He's getting ready to ask permission to put Mordecai to death. But when he comes in, the king asks him the question before he can make his request. What should I do for the person I want to honor? Haman's thinking, well, who would he want to honor more than me? So he gives him this wonderful, elaborate answer of all the prestigious things that should be done. And then the king surprised him and say, well, that's what I want you to do to Mordecai. And so he has to do it. And so all his glory goes to Mordecai. But it's not just that issue. Much more seriously is the whole matter of the life of Mordecai. Remember, he wants him dead. Well, as the story continues in the chapter 7, verses 9 through 10, we find out that Haman ends up at one point arousing the anger of the king. He crosses the line. The king is angry. And so then it doesn't go so well for Haman. So here's what we're told in chapter 7, verses 9 through 10. And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, behold also the gallows that the cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, that standeth in the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him thereon. So they hang Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And then the king's wrath was pacified. And so when he gets the king angry, the king puts him to death. Nine, does he put him to death? He puts him to death, ironically, on the very gallows that Haman had prepared for Mordecai. It's a total reversal. And so Mordecai lives, and the Jewish people, well, they too will end up surviving. Well, how? Well, we get to this as the story progresses into chapters 8 through 9. Remember that earlier the king had passed a royal decree saying, I'm authorizing the soldiers to go out and to wipe out all the Jews, and they can't have weapons to protect themselves. Well, word of this comes to Mordecai, and Mordecai is able to get a message to the queen, who goes in before the king and makes a request. So we pick up then in chapter 8 and verse 3, we're told that Esther spake yet again before the king and fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite, and his device that he had devised against the Jews. So she goes in and begs, please, you've got to undo this. Continuing on then in verses 7 and 8, the response of the king. We're told, then the king Ahasuerus said unto Esther the queen, and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him they have hanged upon the gallows, because he laid his hand upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews, as it liketh you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. And so he will now issue another decree that counters the first decree. Now technically he can't 100% counter the original decree in terms of making it null and void, but for all practical purposes he can do that. And how does he do that? Well, he writes in the decree that the Jews will now have the right to self-defend and protect themselves when that day comes. Hint, hint. The king doesn't want the Jews wiped out. He wants them to live. And anybody with common sense takes the hint. Oh, okay, don't kill the Jews. And if anybody tries to, well, they're going to have the right of self-defense. And so how does it end up panning out when the chosen day arrives? Well, chapter 9, verses 1 through 5, we're told, now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them, that the Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all people. And all the rulers of the provinces, and the lieutenants, and the deputies, and the officers of the king helped the Jews, because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went out throughout all the provinces. For this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. And thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, and slaughter, and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. And so when the day came, the Jews were able to protect and defend themselves, and most people were afraid to lay a hand on them, and that those who had planned to lay a hand on them were the ones that ended up losing their lives. And so once again, it's a total reversal. So, Mordecai in particular is preserved and protected. The Jewish people as a whole are preserved and protected. But now, since God is never once actually named, and since these events, this total turnabout events, is never directly attributed to God in the book of Esther, how do we really know that this was God who worked this turnabout? I mean, after all, there was no direct intervention of God, no handwriting on the wall that said, I'm doing this and here's why. Now, we have something like that, as we saw last week in the book of Daniel, where God miraculously does have a hand appear and spell it out exactly what he's doing and why on the plaster there on the wall. But we don't have anything like that happening in the book of Esther. So how do we know that God had anything to do with this? Well, if I raise that question, you might reply and say, oh, come on, this was such an incredible turn of events. Surely all of this is not coincidence. You might say, come on, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to discern the hand of God in this. Well, then herein is a valuable lesson for us. Now, because this story is recorded in the Bible, we don't hesitate to see providence at work. We don't hesitate to assign this wonderful deliverance to, surely this is the handiwork of God. Because, you know, it's a Bible story, right? But a key takeaway from this story is that we should learn from this, that we must learn to see the hand of God at work in our lives, even if he's not intervening in obviously miraculous ways with visions and dreams and miracles and all that kind of stuff. We still must be willing to see the hand of God at work. To do so is not being presumptuous. Rather, it is exactly what we should do. There is a God who rules in the affairs of men, and we shouldn't hesitate to recognize and acknowledge that fact in our lives. And thus it is. God delivers the people, and he protects them. This is one of the ways in which he manifests his providence. But the other key way in which God manifests his providence in the book of Esther actually occurs in the prologue, the first couple chapters. Now, earlier I said the prologue basically just sets the scene and introduces us to the key characters, the king, the queen, Mordecai, and that's true. But it does more than that. In the prologue, it turns out that here we encounter God's providence to a great degree, insofar that this is where we actually see God providing for his people. Now you note that I do use that word provide. See, the word provide actually consists of two words, pro and vide, or provision, provision. The word pro means before or in advance, and the word vision or vide refers to the idea of seeing something. To provide is to see in advance. You look, you see what's coming down the road, you anticipate what is going to happen, and therefore you prepare for that. Well, God is sovereign. He provides. That is, he sees the future. He knows all that the future holds. But not only does he know the future, he responds accordingly. He prepares for the future. And so in the prologue, what we realize is that God has been providing, that is, he has been preparing for this problem all along. Now, the first time you read through the book of Esther, you don't realize it. You think the prologue's just scene setting, introducing us to the key characters, because the real conflict, the adversity, the drama doesn't begin until chapter 3. But once you read through the whole book, then you look back in retrospect, and that's when you get the aha moment. You say, ah, there's a lot more going on in chapters 1 and 2 than I realized. God was providentially at work. He was providing. It's the phenomenon where, you know, you've probably heard it said that before I even asked the question, God had an answer. Before I even came to God and prayed about a problem, God already had the solution all worked out. This is exactly what we see being illustrated in the book of Esther. Before the problem even takes place, God already has the solution. He's been setting it up. And there are a number of things that God does in preparing that solution to the problem of genocide that's going to arise later in the book. So let's take a look at some of these things. First of all, for example, we find Mordecai is put in this position of serving in the palace. He's working there in the administration of the king. Well, that's no coincidence that this obscure Jew is put right in the palace. He's at the right place at the right time. And this happens 12 years before the problem of genocide ever arises. You see, 12 years in advance, God is already working out the solution. Number two, the king's original queen, his wife Vashti, is deposed. She crosses him, he gets really angry at her, and he's done with her, and so he removes her and takes her off the scene. Well, you see, God is just setting this up, opening the door for Esther when she will eventually replace Vashti as the queen. Now, after he deposes Vashti, he ends up going to battle against the Greeks. You know, the Persians, it always annoyed them that they had conquered the whole ancient world except the Greeks running around on those islands over there. They just couldn't get the best of them. They couldn't subdue them. So, King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, decides he's going to go over there and conquer the Greeks. But he loses. One of the more famous battles in all of history, the famous Battle of Salamis, he loses. The Greeks, I mean, they beat him. I mean, they absolutely shame him. But he comes back home to Persia, having suffered a devastating loss. He has been shamed, he's been disgraced, he's depressed, he's dejected. He just wants life to return back to normal. And as a key step to a return to normal and finding a little solace of comfort, it's getting a new wife, a new queen. And so the search begins to find a lovely queen for the king. And we've got Esther, again, an unknown, obscure woman who happens to be Jewish, but she's a lovely young lady, catches the eye of the king. She is his choice. She becomes his queen. Now, I'm sure if you asked King Ahasuerus, he would tell you that he chose her because he was attracted to her, because she was a beautiful young lady. But that's not the biblical way of reading history. See, the average person, that's how he'd look at it. He'd look and say, well, historically, the way it happened is she was beautiful, so he chose her as the queen, you know. But that's not really the biblical way of looking at history. See, the biblical perspective is 100% the opposite. He didn't choose her because she was beautiful. Rather, God caused her to be born beautiful. He gave her the right genes, the right DNA, the genetics, so that as she grew up and developed into a young lady, she would just be a stunningly beautiful and attractive young lady, so that the king would choose her. So again, he didn't choose her because she was beautiful. Rather, God made her beautiful so that the king would choose her. This is God setting the stage, putting her at the right place, again, at the right time. So 5 years, a full 5 years before the problem of potential genocide arises, God is setting the stage, putting her in the right place. The fourth thing that happens in these first couple chapters of the story in the prologue is that Mordecai actually saves the king's life. It turns out there is an attempted assassination attempt against the king. Mordecai, gets word of this and saves the king. So look, for example, how chapter 2 records this little detail for us. It's a very quick little narrative, just kind of tells that detail, and then the story moves on, doesn't make much of it. It's one of those things, once again, that only as you progress through the story, later in retrospect, you look back and realize, oh, this was God at work. So chapter 2, verses 21 through 23, we're told, in those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when the inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were both hanged on a tree. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So you got these two fellows that want to assassinate the king. Mordecai finds out, gives word, saves the king. And is there any kind of reward or acknowledgement from the king? No. It's just a day's event, and so it's recorded in the Chronicles and put into the archives, but never recognized, never rewarded for that. And, you know, here is a noteworthy observation. Even in life, when your good deeds seem to go entirely unnoticed, unappreciated. Your hard work, but nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Nobody seems to appreciate. Even that can be in the providence of God. Even the failure of anybody to see, notice, or care what you have done may well be the providential outworking of God for some greater, grander plan. Well, finally, the fifth key thing that happens in the story, that is the providence of God, And the king has a sleepless night. Now, this comes in chapter 6. As the story unfolds, we get to chapter 6. And verse 1, chapter 6, verse 1 begins by telling us, on that night could not the king sleep. They just cannot fall asleep. Just restless, you know, one of those cases where you just get a little insomnia. Now, everybody has that now and then. Everybody gets a little insomnia. And you just can't sleep. It's not that big of a deal. You don't think that much of it. And so most of us really wouldn't make much of anything like that. But it turns out that that sleepless night was a very big deal. It was providential. It was from the hand of God. For notice what happens here. Let's read verses 1 through 3 here in chapter 6. On that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the king said, well, what honor and dignity had been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. And so, because the king can't sleep, he says, well, bring and read to me the Chronicles out of the archives. A lot of that's pretty boring stuff, day-to-day affairs of the kingdom, administrative stuff. Maybe that will put me to sleep. So they're reading this to him, but as they read, they run across this account of how some years before Mordecai had saved him. The king says, well, it doesn't say anything about him being rewarded. What reward did he get? No reward at all. Well, the king says, well, we've got to do something about that. I wonder how we can honor and thank that guy. So this then is when we get to the point that Haman shows up to the king's court, planning on asking him for permission to put Mordecai to death. But before he can ask the king that question, the king poses to him a question. What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And this is where Haman thinks, well, he's got to be speaking about me. But he's not thinking about Haman, he's thinking about Mordecai. And so this is where everything begins to change. Everything begins to switch. And so you see, what God has been doing in these earlier chapters, years before there was actually a problem, is God has been preparing the answer before there was even a problem. This can be illustrated. I often think when I read the book of Esther, is that childhood game that we would all play with dominoes. So what kid didn't at one time or other get a bunch of dominoes, and you begin setting them up in a long line, and you zigzag it and roam it all around across the floor of the room, and you spend all kinds of time into setting it all up. And after putting all this effort and time and the planning and setting up all the dominoes, then with great joy you stand back and you just tap that first domino, and it falls. When it falls, it hits the second domino, and then hits the next one, and the next one, and all they go. You sit back and you watch all the dominoes fall. That's essentially what God has been doing. You see, God has been setting up dominoes. And now, as we get to chapter 6, this is the entire turning point of the story, where God now just flicks that first domino. God causes the king to have a little insomnia. And when he has the insomnia, the first domino has fallen. And now a whole series of events are going to unfold that will result in the deliverance, not only of Mordecai, but of the entire Jewish nation. And so we could return back to our general illustration of how you outline the book, or in this case, it's not a formal outline. It's more of a visual illustration of these concentric circles. Again, by way of reminder, chapters 1 through 2, the left side of the red circle, we've got the prologue that sets the stage, but it shows us God also working providentially to prepare an answer for a problem that hasn't yet been encountered. And of course, this is complemented by chapter 10, where we get the epilogue, where the people celebrate and then initiate the Feast of Purim that will commemorate God's providential working for all the years to come. Then as we work inward in the circle, we get to the second ring, the blue ring. Now, the left side of the circle, again, we've got chapters 3 and 4 here. This is where the king initially issues a decree to send forth soldiers and wipe out all the Jews. But this is complemented then by the right side of the blue ring, chapters 8 through 9, where he issues a second decree that essentially is nullifying the original decree, gives the Jews the right to defend themselves, and makes it clear that the king wants them defended. Then as we move inward to the circle, we get to the green circle, the green ring, the left side of the ring. Chapter 5 is where we have Haman. He has an alpha Mordecai, wants to kill him. And this is complemented then by chapter 6 through 7, where we find a reversal that rather than Haman seeing the destruction of Mordecai, it's Mordecai who sees his destruction. All the glory he wanted comes to Mordecai. Meanwhile, Haman is put to death on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. So it's a total irony. Finally, smack dab in the middle of the book, the bullseye of the target, so to speak, is the king's one sleepless night. For you see, that night of insomnia, that's the hinge in which the entire story turns. This is the point where we move from plan to implementation of the plan, from God's provision to God's protection. Now then, as we understand the story and how it's presented to us in the book of Esther, what's the big takeaway? What do we do with this? We've encountered truth, a true event that happened in history. What do we learn from it? First of all, what we need to learn is be willing to see the invisible hand of God at work in all the affairs of your life. I love the way this truth comes across so powerfully, especially in chapter 4 of the book of Esther. In chapter 4, verses 13 through 14, this is the part of the story where Mordecai has gotten word of this new decree that the king has just signed authorizing genocide of the Jewish people. Well, he sends word to Esther, knowing that she's got the ear of the king, she's a queen. He says, you've got to take advantage of this position you're in to do something. You've got to go into action. And so, chapter 4, verses 13 through 14, we're told, then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house, more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So Mordecai is saying, listen, I know that the Jews are God's chosen people, and he's got future plans for us, so he's not going to let us be destroyed. But the question is, how is he going to protect us? Well, Esther, the question you need to ask is, maybe it is through you. Maybe the reason you are where you are is because God put you there. Who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? See, Esther, you need to be willing to see the providential hand of God in this. You need to recognize that God has put you where you are for a reason, and you need to do something with that knowledge. You need to do something with that truth. You need to act to save the people. And as it was true with Esther, so it should be true in our lives. And this is true whether it involves blessings and good times. You know, when we see good things happen into our life, we ought to acknowledge the hand of God in that and say, God, thank you for blessing me in such and such a way. Thank you for answering such and such a prayer. But it's equally true with the times of trials and tragedy and pain and loss in our lives. We need also to see the hand of God in that as well. As Job said, shall we receive good at the hand of God and not evil? Take, for example, the whole pandemic that the world is currently suffering, that we're dealing with here in our country. This is indeed a terrible tragedy. But it is worth asking at such a time, you know, is there something good that God could bring out of this? Is it possible that our sovereign God has permitted and allowed this for some greater purpose? Is God perhaps trying to get our attention? Trying to get us to think about God and our relationship to God, for example? Maybe there's something God's trying to tell us. Now, many people would be enraged at such a suggestion. Oh, they're perfectly okay with giving God the credit and the glory for the good things when things go well, but times of tragedy and loss, oh, don't pin that on. Don't bring God. And God had nothing to do with this terrible tragedy. How dare you suggest that God allowed that pandemic? You know. But, you see, we have to be willing to recognize the sovereign hand of God and the providence of God in all the affairs of life, the good as well as the bad, recognizing that God is trying to work something out. So it's not such a bad thing to ask a question like that. If our good God has permitted even such a trial, so that he can bring something good out of it in our lives. And so it is on a very personal level that you need to be willing to see God's hand at work in the affairs of your life. And this means not just in the very kind of obvious way in which God seems to intervene in our affairs. An example might be, you know, you get the fellow ends up in this terrible, horrendous car accident. The car is totaled and is totally smashed. And when the accident is over, you look back at that vehicle and what just unfolded, and you say, there's no way I should have lived through that. Humanly, it just doesn't even seem possible to be able to explain this. How can we explain this? How could I have survived this terrible accident? You can't chalk that up to luck. This had to be the hand of God. And so there are times like that when we look at something like that and we say, yeah, I think God had something to do with this. But it's not just the obvious times where we need to be willing to see the hand of God. Even the smallest and the slightest and the most insignificant events in our lives can represent the providential work of a sovereign God. For again, in the story of Esther, what do we see? It was just something as significant as a little insomnia. So one night the king couldn't sleep. Who doesn't have a little insomnia now and then? No big deal, right? Turned out it was a really big deal. The whole story hinges on that one sleepless night. That was the providence of God. And so you see, for the Christian, none of life is insignificant. We must always be aware of God's presence. We must always be attuned to His will that He is working out in our lives. We must always be alert to His working. Now, having said that, there is a point of clarification I want to issue. We cannot always be sure of what God is up to. Of course, we are not God's designated spokespersons. We don't know what God is up to other than the things that God has told us in His written word. If He doesn't say it in the Bible, we don't know. All right? So we don't always know what God is up to. But we can think, we can suggest, we can wonder about these things, and we should. But we need a little humility. We always have to be tentative in this regard. And a good example of this would be Job. When Job had all those terrible things happen in his life, he knew God was up to something. God was doing something. But what? He didn't know. And he never found out. So sometimes we simply don't know what God is up to. But the point is this. We can be sure that He is up to something. We can always recognize the providence of God, even if we don't know exactly what it is providentially that He's doing. Secondly, not only should we be willing to see the hand of God at work in the affairs of our life, we should also be ready and prepared always to use the providential working of God as a vehicle, as a tool for sharing our faith. See, those who have not yet come to a place of faith in Christ, those who do not share our faith and confidence in God and the Bible, can nonetheless get an introduction to God. And again, you know, this is what the Bible is. It's a revelation of God, and it has taught us to see Him in the providential affairs of men. And so we can use God's providential working in our lives to introduce people to God, to help open their eyes and learn to see God at work. As I said, this is what the book of Esther teaches us. We see this illustrated in this very book. A couple great examples of this. First of all, look at chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 13. Chapter 6, verse 13 is when Haman comes home. He's very frustrated because he's just been humiliated. He thought the king was going to honor him. Instead, the king says, I want you to honor Mordecai. Comes home, tells his wife and his friends. And I want you to notice the way that they respond to him. Chapter 6, verse 13, we're told that Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him. His wife and his friends, they say, well, look, if that Mordecai guy is a Jew, you don't stand a chance. You've already begun to fall, and the harder you try, it's only going to work against you. You're not going to succeed. This is incredible. Think, his wife and his friends, they are pagans. You know, they had devised this plan originally using divination and their belief in the powers of magic to control the forces of nature and to get the gods working on their side. This is how they chose the whole date to begin with and put it on the calendar when they're going to wipe out the Jews. But now his wife and his pagan friend, they're starting to rethink that. You know what? I think the God of the Jews is more powerful than our magic. I think the God of the Jews is more powerful than our God. I think their God is working things out in their favor. So you see, even a pagan began to rethink his worldview. Even the pagans were seeing the hand of God and began to reckon with, what are the ramifications of that? What does that mean for our lives? What a wonderful tool for sharing our faith. And again, look at chapter 8 and verse 17. Chapter 8 and verse 17. This is where, the day has come, and some people who hate the Jews so bad are going to try to go forward with this plan of wiping out the Jews, but the Jews get to defend themselves. And we're told in chapter 8, verse 17, that in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day, and many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. You've got all these pagans, and a bunch of them, they actually convert to Judaism. They begin to worship the true God of heaven, the God of the Jews. Why? Because they have seen the providential hand of God at work. And so, don't hesitate to share with your friends who are not yet there. They don't have the confidence in God and the Bible that you do. They have not yet come to a place of putting their faith and staking their eternity on Jesus Christ and His atoning death. But don't hesitate to begin introducing them to God by helping them see God at work in your life. Share with them the answers to prayer, for example. Show them that your God is a God who delights in answering the prayers of His people. You see, you begin to introduce them to the providential work of God. It doesn't take powers and signs and wonders and miracles. Just the everyday affairs of life. Let them see God at work in your heart and in your life. So in conclusion then, the bottom line, what we do with this truth, the big takeaway is, number one, be alert and attuned to God's providential working in your life. Secondly, be thankful, be grateful. No matter what comes your way, precisely because you know that God is at work and He's going to do something good, even if at this point you don't really fully understand exactly what that good is and what he's up to. And finally, don't allow the devil, like a master magician, to misdirect your attention and cause you to lose your focus so that you begin to doubt God and wonder, where is God in all of this? Has God abandoned me? For we have been assured in the Scripture that the Lord will never forsake you. He will never leave you. Well, I'm going to leave it there this morning. I wish you a blessed and a happy Lord's Day.